Welcome to Book Waves. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Munil Suri, whose latest book is The City of Devi, earlier novels, The Death of Vishnu and the Age of Shiva. Munil Suri is also a mathematician, which we'll talk about a little bit. And I interviewed you, I believe, for Death of Vishnu several years ago. This is the third novel, and each of the novels has the name of a god. I understand that this was originally, you were looking at Brahma, but somehow Devi came up because you were writing about Mumbai. Is that correct?
Yeah, pretty much. When I first started this kind of triptych almost, thinking that there are three gods, Shiva, Vishnu, and Brahma. And then somehow while I was doing this book, somewhere in the middle, Brahma sort of lost his place and Devi emerged instead. Equal opportunity, I guess. You need a woman up there.
Before we get into the book itself, I don't know anything about these Hindu gods. Why would it be Brahma rather than Devi to begin with? I mean, what's the distinguishing characteristic of these gods, and does that characteristic play a role in those novels?
Vishnu is the preserver of the universe, the caretaker. And, you know, in the first novel, there was a similar character in the book. Shiva is the destroyer. He's also called the ascetic because he withdraws from the world. And so, again, there was some play on that mythological factor in the second book. Brahma is the creator. And in this book, what's happening is that Bombay, or Mumbai, if you like, is under the threat of nuclear attack. And there is this deity that's actually appeared, some sort of manifestation. And this deity might either save the city or destroy it. Well, Brahma can only create, so he doesn't really fit that picture. The mother goddess, on the other hand, she has all these incarnations. She's the destroyer, she's the creator, so she could do either. And also, she is related to Mumbai. Mumba means mother. Mumba and I both mean mother in Marathi, and Mumba Devi is the patron goddess, so it seemed appropriate to make her the central name in the title.
This is a story taking place in the near future. It takes place during what appears to be a kind of nuclear war, but it's the near future, but it is kind of science fiction-y in that sense. Is the origin that you wanted to examine what would happen under those conditions, or does it derive from the characters?
It's really from the characters, and so there's just a threat of nuclear war. And what I needed to do was I needed to create a scenario where these characters were completely desperate. So the scenario is that Pakistan is threatening to, you know, blow up India in 4 days. And so these people know that they only might have 4 days left. And what are they going to do with their lives? And so that's why they take such extraordinary risks, because they want to search for the people that they've lost, their true loves.
As the book opens, Mumbai is already, Bombay, which we'll go into itself, already is kind of in ruins, which is why I said they're in the middle of the war at this point. The question is whether Mumbai will survive at all or not. I also understand that your first book, Death of Vishnu, that was third person. Your second book was done in the second person, which is a woman talking to her child.
Right.
This book was also originally going to be second person of Sarita, one of the three main characters, talking to her missing husband. And somewhere along the line, you decided to make it first person and add another character. Was the original idea the triptych, the three characters of Sarita, Karun, and Karun's male lover? Was that always in the back of your mind?
It was, actually. So Jazz is the male lover, and I knew that I wanted to have Karun as a sort of almost like a cipher, and he's harder to get to know, and that's part of his allure, I think. And so you only get to know him as a character more as the book progresses. But these two people, Jazz and Sarita, are essentially looking for him, and it seemed easiest to have it in the first person, where I had to jump back and forth between the present and the past to explain their relationship, and it just seemed to work better in first person.
Well, when it was that original second person story, I mean, did you reach a point where you're just scratching your head going, I don't know what to do now? Is that what happened?
What happened was, to tell you the truth, the second person story was, it was almost a combination with the second book, where the son in that book might have grown up to be Karun in this book. So at some point I was toying with the idea that it might be just one long book, but that didn't really gel. And also, the second person, you know, I'd already done that, so let's do something different. I've tried to make each book very different. As you said, this one is more speculative fiction. It's set in the future. It's much wilder in that sense.
Manil Suri, the opening up of the character, the point of view characters, brings us to the character of Jazz, which transforms the book about a third of the way into it as a kind of gay novel, which kind of took me by surprise, actually.
Yeah, and that was great fun. I mean, I had planned it, but I think once I got Jazz right, originally he was, you know, in the second person, and he was a much more sedate character, and he was an American, actually. And so when I got into the first person, his voice came to me, and he's completely irreverent. He's got all these one-liners, and he's, you know, always wisecracking. And he just fit perfectly with the whole kind of gay type of, you know, there's some gay people who are perfectly like that. So Jazz is someone who's grown up all over the world, and he really finds himself. He's had all these emotional problems. He really finds himself through sex, through his own sexuality. And so he's very honest. He has a lot of sex in the book. And that's why you said, you know, it's sort of a gay novel in one-third of the way.
What it also means is that you as a gay man suddenly are able to, in a way, be out in your novel.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it was very liberating, I think, especially since there haven't been that many gay characters in Indian fiction, certainly not, you know, such out characters who kind of are so honest about what they're doing sexually. So that was a challenge in a way, because I didn't know how far I wanted to take Jazz. I decided to go all the way. And so I was wondering when I went to India what the reaction would be, whether people would be scandalized or, you know, say, let's teach this guy a lesson or something. So anyway, the book actually released in India first about in the beginning of January this year. So it was an interesting reaction there.
What was the reaction?
It started in Calcutta, and before my reading there, I was warned that Calcutta is a very conservative city. So whatever you do, don't read out the Jazz sections. And if you do, don't read out a sex scene. So naturally, that's exactly what I did. And you know, I've been going around telling people that the audience was fine, nobody fainted, nobody walked out. But actually, it turns out, and somebody heard me say this, and somebody who was at the reading, and they corrected me. They said that they saw three people walk out with great disapproval on their faces. And then there was this other conversation going on where father and son were saying, did he really say that? He couldn't. He's mad. But still sitting there and enjoying it.
That brings up an entire area that I'd like to discuss here, because it plays a role in City of Devi, but it's also how we live. What is gay life like in India? I mean, you live in the United States, you've been to San Francisco, you live in the Washington, D.C. area. What's the difference between that? The sense I got in the book is that it's far more old-fashioned. If you're gay, you're kind of expected still to get married and produce children.
Well, not only that, but many gay people would want that for themselves. There's an intense amount of parental pressure to have an heir in particular. So people will often fulfill that duty. In terms of gay bars and so on, there aren't any. I mean, there was one for a while in Bombay, which the gay community has sort of taken over part of this restaurant, but that closed down. And now the way that they meet is they have these parties where they will rent a disco or rent a club for one night, and then maybe every 2 weeks they'll have one of these parties. They'll have gay film festivals and so on. There's a lot of stuff on the web, so that's the way you get in touch with people. And there's still a lot of kind of things, activities that are more revolving around sex rather than, you know, actual dating or actual relationships. I think that's changing, though. While I was there this January, there was an entire issue of Time Out Mumbai, which is the big magazine there, on gay life in Bombay. So that was very interesting.
Jazz wanders the parks. It kept feeling almost as if India, or at least Bombay, is kind of like 60s or 70s U.S., about 40 or 50 years behind the times.
Again, I think Jazz is, you know, you have to look at it through his viewpoint. So I don't think all gay people would subscribe to that kind of life. But there are certain hoary stereotypes. For example, there's this Ganesh festival, which takes place in the middle of the city, and this is documented in a book called Gay Bombay. And in the midst of immersion of these deities, there's a place on the beach where a circle is formed, and there are people actually having an encounter there in the midst of this seething humanity. So that's quite amazing. I've never seen it in person, but I've heard about it.
Manil Suri, you're talking about these one or two parties, and yet Bombay has millions and millions of people. There must be millions of, or at least hundreds of thousands of gay men and women.
Exactly. And so where do they meet and what do they do? And as you said, a lot of it is underground, where they might have, you know, 60s or 70s type of lives and then do things that are more hidden from their colleagues and parents and so on. And again, I think those things are changing. India just is in the process of legalizing gay sex, which the Supreme Court is still considering it, but it has been struck down in Delhi, for instance, so the laws against sodomy. So I think we're seeing progress, and things happen very fast in India. Also, you have to remember, in India, there is Hinduism, is the sort of main religion, and in Hinduism, you never have the words, thou shalt not. It's always do whatever you want because you have to go through all these stages. So you'll never see anyone holding up a book and saying, you know, this is against Hinduism, because that's just not going to happen. It's not there. There's a great fluidity in gender in India, and there is enormous amounts of accommodation. So I can see the country just shrugging its shoulders and going by and accepting gay people.
Well, also Mumbai itself is a far more cosmopolitan city than, say, Calcutta as well.
Yeah, but I think in all the major areas, urban areas, you'll find similar things happening.
Given the fact that Bombay has also has a large Muslim population, they, I guess, would be more conservative in that area.
I would suppose so. In general, you know, the Muslim community might be more conservative, but there are probably sections of Hindus as well that are very conservative. So the interesting thing about India and Bombay in particular is that all of these people live next to each other. They might not like each other, but they have to live together. So I can see that the gay population would also form an enclave like that. That's one of the successes of India, I think, that, you know, these people would ordinarily be at each other's throats. And certainly the country, when it was first formed, was partitioned into Pakistan and India. A lot of people lost their lives in that. But somehow, you know, it struggles on, and things might flare up at a while and then calm down again.
Well, I know that in, I think it was 1994, there were riots. And before that, in Bombay itself, Muslims and Hindus got along really well. And then suddenly something changed.
I think what you're thinking about was as a result of the there was a series of bombings and so on, and then there was the whole Babri Masjid thing. So there have been flare-ups, especially where Hindu right-wing parties have gone after Muslims. That's one of the things that forms the backdrop of this book, too, where the city actually has been divided into Hindu and Muslim areas. And Sarita is Hindu and Jazz is Muslim, so they're able to sort of negotiate these competing gangs and try and find Karun.
Well, it also creates for you the ability to, through Sarita's eyes and Jazz's eyes, to see the conflicts going on in Bombay today. I mean, that offers another opportunity for you.
Right, absolutely. And it's one of the things that we're not just looking at Bombay, but also the kind of geopolitical surroundings of India, where, you know, we have this neighbor, Pakistan, that is nuclearly armed, like India itself, and China is sitting there. So there's a kind of triangle there. This is one of the other things in the book, that in the past there have been flare-ups between India and Pakistan, and the West always steps in to kind of calm things down. And what happens in this book is the West gets embroiled in cyber attacks and cannot really play a role, and that's why things get to this level.
Manil Suri, the character of Sarita, by the end of the book, both she and Jazz have more or less taken equal time, but for the first part of the book, it's mostly Sarita's book. Did you find it difficult to write through her eyes because of all these potential prejudices, or was that easy? Did she come fully formed?
I actually started this book in 2000, so it's taken me 12 years, and I think she slowly became more and more real to me. She was actually easier than Jazz in a way, because she didn't need that sudden flash. She sort of built up layer by layer. I think the way that I always look at her is she's not quite sure of her own attractiveness. she's had some problems getting married. So when she sees Karun and meets him and it seems like there could be something between them, she sort of invests all her chances of happiness in him. And when the novel starts, she wants to find him since he's been missing for 2 weeks. And not just find him, but also find out what's been happening with their marriage, because she can't quite put her finger on that.
There's a point where I'm thinking, because I had not read ahead, I'm thinking, God, he sounds gay.
Yes.
And at one point someone says to her, well, maybe he's gay, and she goes, no.
Yeah, so I think what happens is that her sister says, well, at least you know he's not a homo, it's because that's a word they still use a lot in India.
Manil Suri, it is a kind of quest novel. The quest is to find Karun and rescue him,
right?
Which means they travel through Bombay's terrain. I assume that that is all real. I mean, there is actually a Skylink highway.
Yes, absolutely. The Skylink highway was inaugurated a few years back. Since it's been 12 years that I've been writing this, I've had to update things as I went along. And, you know, even towards the end, the Arab Spring happened, so I had to put in a reference to that. So, I mean, you have to remember I started this before 9/11, so it's been a process. But, yeah, in terms of the actual geography of Bombay, I actually walked most of this distance that the characters, you know, they go on their odyssey. So I was able to go along and find these things that I said, okay, I have to put this in the novel. It was like a kid, you know, with all these building blocks. I could put them in and then blow them all up.
There is a map in City of Devi, but what I wound up doing was going to Google Maps, not only looking at the map, but then looking at the images that they were seeing at that particular time. So it kind of, for me, became kind of a travelogue.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think what really worked for me in the novel was the fact that Bombay is such a south-to-north city. It's a very elongated city, which used to be seven islands, and that geography works perfectly for the story.
The rich area is Colaba, which is down at the bottom.
Right, South Bombay.
South Bombay, and gradually you get slums next to wealthy areas?
Well, slums, that's an interesting thing about the city, where each time a building goes up, a skyscraper goes up, the people who actually build the building, they need a place to stay, so they make up these makeshift little huts around it, and those then become permanent. So you'll see this over and over again in the landscape. There are these tall skyscrapers rising out of these clusters of slums. So there are slums everywhere, actually.
People sleeping in the streets?
Yeah, it gets harder in the monsoons, but in which case they will try to find a little landing, like in the first novel that I wrote. You know, this man used to sleep on the landing in a building. So there's a lot of people in Bombay. There's like almost 20 million, I think. It's very interesting because Bombay is the safest city I've ever been in.
Really?
You can walk anywhere at any time, and you practically just, you're never in danger. It's very unlike Delhi, for instance, where things are much more dicey.
The action culminates in an area called Juhu Beach. That's real.
Right, yes.
Is the Indica Hotel real?
No, that's not real. So there has to be some fabrication. I was going to use the Marriott Marquis, but I figured they wouldn't appreciate that.
You also have dancing and singing in the middle of the novel, and I kept thinking, wait a second, this feels like a Bollywood, but that was intentional.
Yeah, I mean, you know what happened was, while I was doing this novel, I think initially I was very much putting a lot of constraints on myself. This is a literary novel. It has to follow all these rules. It can't deviate too much from the realistic. And then I realized that I couldn't really put it together. And at some point, I sort of just burst through and said, okay, I literally have a train that goes off its tracks. And that was sort of the jumping off point for me. So after that point, I said, okay, people expect all these exotic elements like elephants or pomegranates in Indian novels. Let's throw them in. And let's kind of subvert their expectations by actually giving them a surfeit of them. So you have all these Bollywood elements, and they really fit in, I think.
Including the fact that the bad guy becomes a real bad guy dressed up like a bad guy. I mean, you go all out toward the end.
I absolutely do. So it's a ride that I'm inviting the reader on. And I think it all depends on the reader taking that ride with me. You can either say, okay, I don't accept any of this and, you know, stalk off. Or if you go along with it, it's supposed to be like a roller coaster.
Bombay, Mumbai. When I spoke with Salman Rushdie, I asked him about that because he grew up in Bombay.
Right.
And he said he still calls the city Bombay. Many people call the city Bombay because Mumbai is more of a Hindu thing.
Yes, it was actually a name that was imposed in a way by this same right-wing party that was, you know, responsible for violence against Muslims. And someone like myself or Salman probably grew up saying Bombay. So the natural thing for us is to always call it Bombay. On the other hand, Mumbai, even though it does have this religious connotation of the mother goddess, it is a good name, I think. And it is the name that the city will be known by in the future, just because, you know, there was that hotel massacre, and so that name Mumbai has been splashed around the whole world. So I think it's time to reclaim that name from the fundamentalists, from the religious right, and just use it and say, okay, this is our city, and whether you call it Bombay or Mumbai, it is the same thing.
But I got the sense in an interview that you did that part of saying Bombay also goes back to when you were younger and the city was very different too. I mean, so it's a different feel to it.
I know, but what I'm trying to say is that it is still a good name for the city as it is now. For people like myself, we are probably always going to, you know, keep saying Bombay, Mumbai alternately. But it's time to get past that nostalgia and just claim this as the rightful name of the city.
The city has many languages. How many of them do you speak?
I just speak Hindi and English. Marathi is the local language, and I tried learning it over 8 years, and I can barely say maybe a sentence or two.
And these characters would all speak Hindi?
They would speak English, I think.
Really?
Yeah, they would speak English to themselves. They would speak Hindi to someone like a taxi driver or someone on the street. So it would be a mixture of them. But with amongst themselves, they would probably speak English.
So when we're reading this, we're not reading a Manil Suri translation
no.
in his head. We're reading how they would speak.
Yeah, I mean, some of the dialogue is supposed to be in Hindi, but like Karun and Jazz would always speak in English, for instance.
Manil Suri, you're also a mathematician. What is finite element methods for partial differential equations?
How much time do we have exactly?
That's your specialty.
Okay, the one-line answer is that it's a way for engineers to solve very complicated equations that come up when you're, let's say, designing a bridge. I want to figure out if what the stresses are if you have a certain load going over the bridge. This method is a way of approximating these equations and getting a good enough answer.
When I spoke with you many years ago, I seem to recall talking about the relationship between writing and mathematics, and that on some level, both are about problem solving.
That's true. And I sort of took it to maybe a bit of an extreme with this novel, because at some point I was really stuck. And I said to myself, okay, what would a good mathematician do? And the answer is you would make a possibility tree, which you've probably seen in chess games, where white has, let's say, 6 different moves, and then for each of those moves, black could have a few different moves. And you go through this entire tree that you come up with, and you kind of figure out what the best path is. And so I did the same thing with plot elements. Jazz does this, or he does this. Saritha, for each of these alternatives, can do different things. Let's go through all these and see which one takes me closest to something that is believable. And I found out that I kept hitting a blank wall. I kept getting stuck. Either something was too trite or it just didn't work. And finally I realized that I'd come up with a mathematical proof that the novel could not be written. And it took me a while to sort of go over that. You know, that's when that breakthrough came, but the proof really said that the novel could not be written with the strictures that I had put on it. But I had to sort of break through those. I think that's when I saw the central metaphor of these three gods and the three stand-ins of these characters, who are sort of, you know, very similar to the deities that you find in the three titles. Karun is very much the Shiva-like character. He's withdrawing from the world. You know, the mother goddess, she actually appears in a different form in the book as well, as the super devi. And then, of course, Jazz is full of energy. So there is this idea of trying to bring these strands together. That's the kind of thing that I saw in the distance and was able to complete my book with.
I understand that in an interview you said that you threw in all these little triptychs for readers if they go looking. One of them is that there are 3 generations of quarks, and Karun is working on quarks. India, Pakistan, China, the
right.
3 people. What's another one that you can...
Karun's father, for instance, believes that all of human personality arises from strands of Shiva, the ascetic, Vishnu, the energetic person, and Devi, the mother goddess. So everyone is a mixture of these three, and one usually dominates. Then there's another thing about the basic triangle, the basic trinity of these three characters changing. There's first Karun and his father and his mother who form this triangle. And then there is the Jazz, Karun, and Sarita triangle. And then there's something else that happens that it gives way to in the end.
Marmite plays a role, and I had to look it up. We don't get Marmite here.
And
it's
you're
some
lucky.
Kind of food.
You're lucky you don't. It's one of the most vile substances known to man. It's essentially hydrolyzed yeast protein. It's this black tarry stuff that I actually grew up with. I mean, you spread it on toast, and the Brits love it. We had a publishing conference at my publisher's, and I actually took along a jar of Marmite and spread it on crackers and offered it to everyone. And, of course, they couldn't get past the smell. But we forced the head of the publishing company to actually eat it to show that he really was prepared to do any sacrifice for the company.
Sarita has a thing for it. Was that kind of your joke as a chef and someone who knows food?
Right. You know, there are actual chefs who refuse to use it. There was some challenge in Britain, and people said, well, I would never use Marmite. But you do find similar things. It's got a lot of umami flavor. So that's what Marmite gives you, except it's to the nth degree. It's, you know, umami to gag you with. Umami, you know, the Japanese fifth taste, which is found in MSG, and it's found in things like mushrooms and so on. So it's that kind of, a little bit goes a long way.
Every so often you throw in food references as well, and that's because you do a lot of cooking. Someone asked you at one point what you miss most about India, and one of the things you said was pomfret.
Yes.
What's that?
That's a kind of fish. I guess it's closest to pompano, perhaps, but it's this flash fish, and it's just delicious, and it's very different. It's very forgiving. You can cook it in a curry, and it'll still retain its texture and flavor. And I think that's one of the things. And the other thing I think I mentioned was Alfonso mangoes. And those are finally available in the U.S., but they have to be microwaved to get in. So I don't know how well they survive.
Manel Sir, you've also been teaching a class which involves mathematics and literature. And you started by showing the movie Pi. Why?
You know, it's a bad math movie. It has all these things that are put in about chaos theory and Fibonacci numbers, and, you know, somehow there's this mad kind of amalgam this curry that's cooked out of it. So one can have great fun with it. And what the students, unfortunately, really reacted to when we were showing them this movie was not the math and the humanities, but the fact that the mathematician at the end basically drills a hole into his head. So they were reenacting this in class. So we figured we had to go on to the next subject.
You've talked about using math as a metaphor for shining a light on the arts. What exactly does that mean?
With mathematics, there's several interactions that it has with the arts. I mean, there's the kind of mathematical art of fractals and so on, so that's one kind of interaction. But the more interesting interactions are mathematical modeling that can be used, especially in the humanities, to figure out how things evolve. I mean, mathematics, like calculus, is the art of actually quantifying anything that changes. And if you think about what we are looking for in populations and even in history, you're often tracking how things have changed. And I suspect in the years to come, there will be more math in all of these fields. That's already happened with biology, which, of course, is a science. But when I was growing up, there was no math in it. And now it's all mathematics. So all of you humanities people out there, you know, brace yourself for the future.
You said before that when you were looking at City of Devi and creating it from a mathematician's perspective, you got stuck and you had to make some kind of transcendent leap. I mean, math can only take you so far.
Absolutely. But what it does do is it gives you some sort of truth. It's another way of expressing a truth. So as I explained that, you know, it did tell me that I needed to make this breakthrough. And that's the sort of danger in or maybe the challenge in actually balancing writing and mathematics, where one is very analytical, and in the other, you kind of have to let yourself go a little bit. I mean, you have to have some uncertainty. Characters are never completely consistent. That's what makes them interesting. So in mathematics, you always insist on complete consistency, but this is why I like the writing, because it's a nice antidote to that.
Well, you also paint as well.
Yeah, I mean, that used to be my primary hobby for a while, and I used to paint Bollywood film posters.
For real films?
Yes, for real films, and that was a lot of fun. My father was actually in the music business for Bollywood, and so I grew up with a lot of that culture, and it was just great fun actually painting on the walls of our living room until I was told I couldn't do that anymore.
So at what point did you decide, you know, hey, I'm going to do writing instead?
I think it was when I started teaching as a professor, and I realized that, you know, with painting, I just wasn't as much into it. Some other Bollywood part had sort of died down. I wasn't seeing those movies anymore. And so I just decided one day to sit down and write a story. And it was just a 2 or 3 page story, but of course I thought it was the greatest story ever written, and I was trying to decide whether to send it to the New Yorker or the Atlantic. Luckily I didn't send it to either, and I wouldn't show it to anyone now. But anyway, that was the start, and it just became a hobby that grew more and more serious. And it was at least about, 18, 19 years before I actually published my novel. So it took a long time.
Manil Suri, you live in the Washington area, and you're from India, and you're kind of in two worlds. How do you look at American politics today?
American politics, well, all I can say is I really like the outcome of the last election, the last presidential election. Unfortunately, India actually has a more dysfunctional system than the U.S. So that's the only thing I can say to say that, okay, things could be worse.
Well, when you say India has a more dysfunctional system, What do you
well,
mean?
I mean, there, you know, I think one of the problems we are having here is that there is this gridlock and nothing can get done because there are these two opposing viewpoints. Well, in India, there have been instances where essentially the government is at a complete standstill. They can't do anything. And when they try to do something, the opposition basically starts shouting and screaming literally on the floor of Congress and just shuts everything down. So that's an even stronger, more hysterical form of gridlock than we have here. You know, India is still a democracy, but if you look at some place like Pakistan, that's even more scary.
And the political fanaticism in India, is it getting worse? Is it calming down?
It's hard to say, because on the one hand, people are moving away from that. I think the younger generations are less inclined to be kind of swept up in that. But on the other hand, there are people who might actually come to power who have been associated with, you know, some sort of massacres of Muslims. So that's the scary part. The one thing that's good about India is that India consists of so many different constituencies that they are constantly realigning themselves, and there can never be a huge religious movement that will sort of carry and sweep the whole country. There's always someone who says, wait a minute, I'm more aligned with the lower caste people. I'm more aligned with the Muslims, even though I'm Hindu, just because we both have lower castes or we have the same language. So that's one reason why the country keeps going on. You know, unity in diversity or survival through diversity.
And I've been given to understand from other Indian authors that the entire caste system is kind of starting to fade.
In terms of where I grew up in Bombay, there's never been a strong caste system. It's always been class rather than caste. So the caste really comes in the south, I think, more than certain other areas of India. I don't know if it's actually fading. I would view that with a big grain of salt, because what's happened is the universities, we have a lot of affirmative action, and that's been taken to such a high degree that 60% of the seats for people going into college might be reserved for a lower caste. And so the upper castes are feeling discriminated against. And so there's a lot of bad blood over there, and it's not clear that that's really clearing up.
And the conflict between Muslims and Hindus themselves. There's a scene early on in City of Devi where in order to determine if someone is Muslim, they rip off their pants.
And this was something that actually did happen in Bombay. I mean, we were talking about that massacre, and they were chasing people and checking to see if they were circumcised or not, because that's the way to tell the difference. Again, a lot of the religious violence occurs because of economic conditions. So if the country does well economically, you might find that this actually goes down. And this, there have been studies after partition which showed that. And it's only when there are economic reasons or political motivations to foment this kind of violence that you see an upsurge. But it's sort of cyclical. So you will have upsurges, but then they will die down as well.
There's a movie, a fictional movie in City of Devi, Manil Suri, called Super Devi.
Yeah.
Does Bollywood play any role in these religious wars, or does it try to stay out of it as much as it can so it can attract everybody?
It does try to attract everybody, but there can be repercussions that they don't really know about. For example, there was a television serial on the Ramayana, the great Indian epic, that was shown in India in the 90s, I think. And people really got involved in it. They would actually make offerings to the screen, to the TV screen, when the gods came on. That is usually linked to the kind of revival of religious feeling in the country. And sure enough, a few years after that, there was a change in the political party that was in power. So it can have political repercussions, even though they're not seen in advance.
Toward the end of the novel, there's what could be a mystical situation involving one of the Hindu gods, and everybody's cheering and doing that. Is that exaggeration, or do you think if something like what happened toward the end of the book actually emerged, that people would be responding like that?
Yeah, absolutely.
Really?
There have been so many instances of there was this famous incident where one day people started claiming that statues of Ganesh were actually drinking milk when you fed them milk. You know, if you dropped milk on them, that Ganesh was actually drinking it. And this rumor spread through the entire country like wildfire, and everyone was feeding their statues milk. Another time, someone said that this very polluted area in Bombay, which is actually mentioned in the book, suddenly the water had turned fresh there. That you know, some god had come along and made the water fresh. So people were actually drinking that water, even though it was just full of contamination and everything. So we do see things like that occurring in India. And certainly if there was a lot of pressure where people expected that the world might end and this was the only way that they would survive, not just in India but in any other place in the world, you would see people coming to a god or someone who claims to be able to save you.
Your next novel is going to be a math novel.
That's the aim, and I've been working on it. I don't want your listeners to start fleeing in horror. And it's going to be accessible to everyone, and it's first and foremost a novel, and then there is math in it. But to help you along with the math, I'm actually putting little bits of video in it with some animation. And what I'm doing is creating these things that will explain some of the math in a very funny and kind of different form. And this will work very well with an e-book, and, you know, it will also be available on the web, so people will be able to hopefully take advantage of that.
So it's going to be kind of a multi-platform in a way.
Right. Multimedia, you know, here I come, that kind of thing. Have to move along with the times. Of course, I'm talking about all this as if it's all done. You know, it takes me 5 years to write anything. So by then, this will also, probably be obsolete.
Well, how far along then are you?
I'm about, I would say about 40 or 50 pages in, so I have a long way to go.
One final question. You were in writing groups all along, and you've written about them. Do you recommend writing groups for people?
I do, absolutely. I learned a lot from these writing groups.
And you've said you would never teach writing. Why not?
It's the fact that so much depends on opinion, that there are so many ways of looking at something. And for me, it's much more reassuring when I'm teaching to know that I have the right answer. And, you know, if you don't agree with me, tough luck. In math, I can just mark something as correct or incorrect, and no one's feelings get hurt. There's no emotion involved. I don't have to worry about couching it in some, you know, way of, well, the writing isn't good, it doesn't work, but on the other hand, your punctuation is wonderful. So that's why.
What do you like better, writing or teaching?
I really don't think I can do without either of them. I've actually tried where I've given up the teaching for stretches of time, and I really was going completely crazy at home. My partner would come home, and I would jump on him, and he said, no, you have to get a life. You have to start teaching again. And the thing is, with writing, you're writing all day, and I did a calculation, and it's about 64 words that actually make it to the printed page per day. I'm up to 69 now. I keep thinking, okay, maybe I can write these books faster if I, you know, give up some of the teaching, but I don't think that'll work.
You've been listening to an interview with Manil Suri, whose latest novel is The City of Devi. I'm Richard Walensky on Book Waves.